to the Athenaeum Review podcast, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Bonnie Pittman, who is Distinguished Scholar in Residence at the Edith O'Donnell Institute of Art History and Director of Art Brain Initiatives at UT Dallas, where she created and directs the program in Art and Medicine. Before that, she was most recently the Director of the Dallas Museum of Art, following positions as Director, Curator, and Educator at the Bay Area Discovery Museum in California, the Seattle Art Museum, and the New Orleans Museum of Art, among others. She's won many awards and is the author of many publications, including the book, Ignite the Power of Art, Advancing Visitor Engagement in Museums. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Ben.
So I wanted to ask you about your major project on art and medicine. And in looking at this, which is very well described and detailed on the O'Donnell Institute website. And I had this idea that, in a sense, this skill of close observation must certainly be extremely ancient, going back to the first people who ever called themselves doctors. But then on the other hand, today there's so much of the kind of quantification and measurement and machines and so forth that, despite being something that is so fundamental to medicine, in a way what you're doing is something of a challenge. I wonder if you could just tell us about kind of how you got started doing this and the story behind it.
It's an interesting story. As I got into the art and medicine field, I was doing my initial research when I was the director of the Dallas Museum of Art. Regrettably, I got an infection in my lungs, which changed my life and caused me to retire from the museum and then happily take a position here at the university, where my work in research and teaching in these subject areas of bridging art and science around perception have really flourished. And I'm grateful to UT Dallas for that opportunity. Exactly to your point, when I was in the hospital so frequently, and because my case is unusual, I'm often used as a teaching tool among mm-hmm. the physicians. And I think the hard part is that many times the students come in having read my chart, or even physicians do, right. And they don't really look at me. And the first set of experiences that I had, except for with my one doctor who was superb, was that there wasn't this interaction. People right. didn't see you. They didn't consider me as a human being as much as looking at the charts and trying to figure out a solution to the problems that I was having medically. And that led me into saying, well, the skills that I have as a museum curator and educator can be translated here into medicine, because observation is critical to both. And the exciting thing was that I had an opportunity at UT Southwestern to develop a whole program that's an eight-week program, 2 hours a week with first and second year medical students, that explicitly looks at the importance, the factors around how we see, how we interpret information, how we deal with ambiguity, which is a big part of what doctors have to deal with, how you come up with creative new solutions. That was the genesis of the program that presented to UT Southwestern, and it launched into a major initiative for them. It's part of what's happening in medical schools today. There is a huge surge in what's called medical humanities. Mm-hmm. And it's a very important field, because physicians have the highest burnout rates in graduate schools and in the professions, because it's such an intense job. And study, as you know, is unlike, you may think you study hard as a scholar in a university, but when you're up all night for weeks, you know, and you're on these tough scheduled shifts, it's very intense for the medical students, residents, and fellows. And so what I wanted to do was to bring in a program that would help them to develop skills that not only were about looking at art, but looking at the world around them, and very importantly, increasing their ability to be a good doctor and participate with their patients by close observation. So the program is happily part of a whole initiative that's really nationwide. I probably work with, I would say, 6 to 10 medical schools and universities that are founding new programs like this around the country every year, because they're getting established. And the particular nature of our program is that we use works of art at the Dallas Museum of Art and at the Clements Hospital, which has a beautiful collection over at UT Southwestern. And we use those works to be the body of our teaching.
So I think it might have been in one of the New York Times articles mm-hmm. about this project. There was maybe someone commented that a lot of the oriented people who are in charge of medical schools sometimes kind of push back against maybe medical humanities in general and say, well, like, you know, why do we need this? And I'm curious. I'm sure you've had many such conversations. I'm curious about what kind of dialogue takes place between like medical humanities people and those who are, let's say, like the doubters, and how you kind of get across the value of this.
Well, it's a very powerful question. I can tell you, Dr. Joel Katz, who's at Harvard University and was one of the early proponents of this program. It took him almost 5 years to get it onto the Harvard Medical School program, in the medical humanities was just emerging. And this was probably 10 years ago. So it was so new and so radical an idea that you would, you know, you're not just teaching hard medicine, but you're really teaching the students or the fellows and residents how to look so that they can come up with a better diagnosis. And for a long time, before you carried around your PDA or your phone, you had to observe closely your patient and make notes. And that skill is not as common. The students aren't trained as well in that. And so a lot of the physicians who are currently practiced are adamant that that needs to be brought back and that the new students don't just rely on technology. I think we're in a much, because today, I've been doing this for now 6 years at UT Southwestern, and it is now so embedded in the program, and there's such high results. In other words, when we do the student assessments at the end of the year, where they come in at 98%. So, yeah, so it makes me happy. And we really emphasize in the program active participation in looking processes, not just, you know, sitting down and looking in a dark hall at art history images. You're in front of paintings, you're acting them out, you're drawing them, you're interacting in dialogues, trying to find points of view that are different than yours, because physicians have to learn to deal with conflict and to deal with different approaches to looking at a patient in different ways. And this school, this class, one of the big things that we've learned out of the class is that the students are very excited that they developed this skill because it's not something that's normally taught in to listen respectfully, to be able to deal with the ambiguity. I think it's this and you think it's that. And so how do we come to a resolution? So learning those skills early on. The other skill that surprised me, and we've had to embed it even more strongly in the program, are the issues around compassion and empathy. And so, of course, at the DMA, there are a lot of wonderful objects, the Buddhas, and I mean, that are obvious, the Buddhas and some of the paintings that we have there. But I also teach the great African statue, the Nkisi Nkandi, when I'm talking about empathy and compassion, because even though he has these huge nails stuck into his body and he's like a judge within the community, he also is there to heal the community by making civic decisions, by making these. He is a place of resolution. So he doesn't wear a white coat. He wears these nails in his body as a way in which to show his connection to you as a human being and to promote to you that he can help you and the community make decisions together. So we need to look at, one of the things the students need to learn how to do is to look at other cultures and other communities to begin to bring in a sense of understanding about how they value cultural differences, cultural bias. So that's been a whole new addition to the program.
So on listening to some of what you're saying, it makes me also curious about the relationship on the medical side between primary care and specialists, because I know like a lot of us as patients mm-hmm. might feel like, well, you know, my primary care like person, he or she, like kind of that's my doctor, and he mm-hmm. or she ideally knows me and knows who I am. And then specialists we might see occasionally, and they, you know, they kind of do their one thing, and then we go back. But it makes me wonder whether the interest you see on the medical side, is it weighted in any way towards the primary care people who have that more holistic mentality, or is it really all the different fields?
It's all over the map. And of course, I'm teaching medical students and residents. Right. So medical students are open, you know, it's just like being an undergraduate, like, should I go into dermatology or radiology, or maybe I'll become a lung specialists, so they're still looking for the right slot. And the advantage of this program is they begin to understand, you know, clusters of people that are moving and that some students already know where they want to go. I think that the other part of it is that close observation is critical, not only in looking at works of art and learning to see the world that you interact and live with, but it also is a way to nourish your life experiences. And so a lot of our work in the assignments between the classes is go out and take pictures of trees or places that you enjoy going to for rest, and that renew your spirit and soul. And they've never thought about those kinds of things, you know, because we're all so busy walking through life, learning how to pause and really engage. We also teach, we have a part of one of our classes is on meditation, the whole process of slowing down. And the lesson there is to basically, and one of the students in the, what is it called, the evaluation of the program said, I never just walk into a room anymore. I stop before I open the door, take three deep breaths, and get centered that I'm going into a new place. So to your very point, when you're a specialist running from room to room doing consults, even taking three breaths can make a huge difference in your ability to focus on this new patient as you walk in the room. And that's, you know, you can say, well, why would that help with close looking? Well, you're slowing your body down. All of your senses are coming into a new focus. And when you enter into the room, you can open your eyes and see this new person and not transfer everything that you've already experienced.
Well, I was looking again. The resources on the website are really amazing. I was looking at some of the courses, and I was curious. You know, for those of us who have taken art history classes in college or whatnot, or who are kind of familiar with, there's a sort of basic. Oh, here's the style and the artist and the period and all that. I was curious if there's a particular assignment or particular topic you might tell us about it, and maybe like. What makes it different from just, you know, art history 101 that you would take in college or something?
Well, I'll give you the classic opening. The first class that I have with the students besides the orientation is many of them are saying, why am I here? You know, I mean, it is an elective, so they signed up, but what am I going to learn? And so in this first class, we take the work, The Abduction of Europa, at the Dallas Museum of Art, which is done by Jean-Baptiste Marie Pierre. And it's a French painting that was done around 1750s. This beautiful young woman, Europa, stretched over in a white gown, of course, implicating her virginity. And then she's laying on the back of the bull, who is, of course, Zeus, taking her off and surrounded by mermen and merwomen. And I use the painting first as a classical example of how do you analyze a work of art, color, line, shape, textures. And they go deeply into it. And then after that, I don't let them read the label, so we put a little flap over it because that's their first inclination is to go up and read the label and have it solved. And what I want them to do is solve this by looking. And then almost there's a long dialogue, lots of questions, and then all of a sudden, at the end of it, it's about 30, 40 minutes into this piece. So we've really looked at one work of art for that amount of time. And a very energetic discussion. And then I have them all turn their backs, all the students turn their backs, and I ask them, who is looking at you directly in the painting? And I've taught this class for 6 years, and every year we get the same results. Out of 35 students, three will get the two figures that are looking at you. Others will get one or the other, and some of them won't get any of them right. You know, they're all convinced that Europa is looking at you. Europa is not looking at you. She's not looking at you at all. And so when they turn around and they figure this out, I said, that's why we're taking this class. Yeah. You've been looking at this painting for 45 minutes.
Yeah. So it makes you realize.
It shocks them. Yeah. I mean, there's no question that it shocks them.
Yeah.
And the marvelous thing is that over the years of teaching with this painting, and it has a wonderful composition, it's very dynamic, it's huge, everybody can see it. And many of them who have had some humanities programs in, in undergraduate work, figure out eventually that it's Europa and it's from Metamorphos and all of that. But the real issue is that I've been looking at this for 30 to 45 minutes and I didn't see who's looking at me. So that's a difference, and I use that to demonstrate why we're in the class. And then there are other wonderful examples that we have in the class. So one of them is on the objects of healing. And I think a lot of us don't realize that the traditions of healing go all the way back to the cave paintings, Paleolithic, 20,000 years ago. You can see them on the caves. You see people that are caring for each other. You see the handprint and things like that. But there's a whole tradition of healing objects made by the Yoruba people, you know, beautiful saints whose single purpose was to watch over you and pray for you. So looking at this long tradition, or some of the great Buddhas in the DMA's collection that are specifically intended, the Bodhisattvas, for healing purposes. So looking at all of that, you begin to look at the different cultures, you begin to look at how we as human beings want and need to be healed. And that is an important part of our spiritual life. I'm not saying you have to be Christian or whatever it's called, or any, I'm not talking about a religious purpose. I'm talking about the manifestation of the soul in healing. So it's a very exciting part of the whole thing to realize that the stories of life are told through works of art. And that's why I teach with the collections, and I teach as much as possible in the collection.
Something, you know, hearing that reminded me of, I'm sure medical people say this all the time, but the kind of slogan about treating the person, not the disease.
Yes.
Isn't there, that's kind of this idea that, we can pause that.
Yeah, I mean, totally, treating the person. And that's a lot of what the focus is. We do a whole session on the human body where you go through the museum and everybody is looking for works of art that find the human body. So two of the most popular ones are, of course, the great Henry Moore, which is on the second level landing at the DMA. And we ask them to get in the pose of the images that they're selecting. And so, of course, with great effort, you watch people roil on the floor trying to figure out, how did that elbow go this way? And I can't hold a child like this. And so suddenly they realize that the distortion in Henry Moore's work, it has a lot to do with, you know, the synergy of ideas and movement. It's not just a static image. And we compare that to another image of a person. There's a wonderful piece where, some of the portraits, like the Copley portraits, where you watch a single figure standing there and she's holding her roses and flower petals and she's very poised. Well, you can get into that figure, but it is. And so they take photographs of that, and then they begin to notice and rearrange each other to say, no, your head has to go a little two more inches to the left, or more inches to the right. And it is so fascinating to watch the micro sectioning that begins to happen once they're comparing themselves to a work of art, or and then translating that into another person, trying to get the other person to take that on. So the learning happens with the student who is acting out the object, and with the team that's trying to get the person to be in the same shape. There's a wonderful statue on the third floor of, what was her name? Godiva, mm-hmm. Lady Godiva.
Yeah.
Alessandra Kameni gave us this piece. And you look at it and it looks like this pristine marble statue of a young lady looking up at the sky. But when you get into that position, then there are all these questions about, is she getting off the horse or on the horse? Is she looking at her husband or away from her husband? And why is her belt untethered just a little bit? So the more they begin to look, then they realize there's all the subtle little interactions going on in the piece that they simply didn't see in the first, you know, few seconds that they were scanning it. And that's why I developed this whole framework on the power of observation. How do you get people to learn how to observe deeply and connect those ideas into your memory?
And so I understand that your research uncovered this sense that there are these four different learning styles that people have. Visitors can be classified as observer, participant, dependent, or enthusiast.
Mm-hmm.
And something that, as a museum visitor myself, I always wondered about as well, how do you approach the challenge? And is it tricky to make the trade-offs between the one style and the other? And how you...
Well, my favorite part, once we did 7 years of research on visitors who were coming to the Dallas Museum of Art, and all of the studies and all of the research were shared with the entire staff of the museum. And because I was the director, I could make everybody come from the guards. And to the curators. You all had to show up and you'd see these massive presentations, and we made them lively and fun and meaningful to them. The result was that afterwards, we would spend 2 days trying to figure out how to implement. So here's the new study that came in, and here's the refinement of our thinking. Because the first year it came out, we didn't have four, we had three. And then we all realized something was wrong because we were missing the independence, the people who want to come on their own and just sort of experience without words. They are knowledgeable, and they just want to be there, and they want experts to talk to. They don't want any interventions. And the reason we realized we were missing that group, because it was everybody in the room, curators, the curators and myself and other people said, where are we in this study? Right. So we went back and reanalyzed the data, indeed came up with four, and the four groups that you just mentioned. And what was exciting was when you try to implement that, and by that I'm saying, okay, you have an exhibition coming up, and you're looking for the budget process that in the end, everything goes down to the budget. How do you spend your dollars on marketing and education and curatorial research to make this the most effective project you can make it and to get the highest number of attendees? Well, part of that was you had to realize that there were some shows that were not going to hit a broad audience. And so we focused in on, let's say, the observers and the and the independents, because they really were a better fit for us to take a person whose first visit to the museum was to go and see a silver fork exhibition or a silver exhibition is hard. It's all one type of material. There are hundreds of pieces. Yes, they're deeply meaningful to a lot of people because it's how we ate and develop the culinary arts, but for the general person walking in the door, it's a big leap. We don't eat off of sterling silver plates and platters right now. So that translation leads to a better understanding of the kinds of programs we would do. So if you're focused on the silver exhibition, then you would do programs that brought people in to show how silver was used and to create kind of party environments so that person who didn't know would begin to understand. But you also did a seminar, because there are real enthusiasts out there, the group that loves art as much as we always said sex and religion. Right. You know, this is the group that just hangs in there for you. But we needed to do programs for the people who were enthusiasts and wanted, and the independents, because they wanted to really hear an expert talk about it. Yeah. So you had to figure out, I mean, the translation of this was into how you allocate dollars for different programs and how you develop those programs. And one of the things, I mean, I think in the book talks about this is so exciting, is we went from an attendance of roughly 300,000 people to 800,000 people in basically a seven or eight year period. And it was phenomenal. And so the question, I mean, there was at one point, a person walking into the Dallas Museum of Art, one in every two people was involved in some kind of an educational experience. I'm not talking about videos. I'm talking about you interacted in some way. You might be making a work of art in the Center for Creative Connections. You might be on a walking tour. You might be any number of things. You might be doing yoga up in the upper galleries. But there was something that engaged you and found your interests and linked it into something else that helped you to understand art. So that was really the crossover from research and ideas into really this manifestation of an institution reaching out and engaging the community. And I really focused on the great collection we had, because the important thing is the collection is there always.
Yeah, I think maybe in one of the other articles, I think you said something like when you started in the museum field, the predominant attitude was something like, just like put it out there and, you know, people will come. And it's come a long way since then. But I think understanding this makes it helps me understand a little bit more, like, to museum. I mean, I guess I'm in that independent category as well, and I see all the, I'm there at the Dallas Museum, and I see, you know, and I see the crowds. I see all the people who come to, you know, right now it's the Dior exhibition, you know, the big special traveling exhibition. I think to myself, oh, I hope they stick around and kind of go, you know, look around and see the collection and the pre-Columbian and all this. Having that framework, it seems like I kind of understand some of these different ways.
Well, what we What we did when I was at the museum is, for example, with the Renoir show that we had, which was really telling the story of the development of the locomotive and how the locomotive got from Paris out to the beaches and this whole big transformation of transportation and other things. And it was told through Renoir's painting. So it was kind of a really interesting opportunity. Well, what we did for that show is we have a huge number of paintings from Diebenkorn to American landscapes that show the beach. So did a huge exhibition from the collection. We invite about the shore. Invited artists to create works of art that complemented it. We didn't have a single label that told you on the labels, instead of having a descriptive text, we had text from Moby Dick and from other authors who had written about the sea and the land. So that exhibition opened a whole new spate of way of looking at our collection in relationship to this Renoir exhibit. When we did two big shows, one was the Tutankhamun show that we had, and we knew people were going to be standing in line for a long time. So we did a handouts and experiences in the galleries that followed showed you how other people who are dealing with deities or gods as deities and the sun gods, where they were in the museum and how to locate them. We don't have an Apollo, but we got you up into the classical collection looking right at some of the jewelry and some of the other images, because they're all placed in there. We did a lot of things that really took you from the exhibition. That was something every exhibition had that we brought in. It took you up into the galleries, whether it was pre-Columbian or the Great Maya Show. We ended up having a huge program in the Mayan galleries, or the Chinese show from the Chinese Emperor Show. So you can do that. And, it takes work on the part of the education and curatorial department to do that. But that was one of the ways that we got people to connect to the museum. Yeah.
I also wanted to ask a little bit about your background. I think you told the story at one point of when you were in school, or when you were a young person, you taking a trip. Grew up in Provincetown, mm-hmm. Is that right? And you took a trip to the National Gallery of Art in D.C. I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit about kind of how you got into this.
Yeah, well, it was I was lucky enough to have a mother who loved art and studied art history, went to Europe a lot. My grandparents were very, very influential, and they lived in Stamford, Connecticut, just outside of New York City. And as I was born in Connecticut, and then my parents went and lived in Provincetown, which is this talk about hippie dropout community with artists. And I mean, Hans Hoffman lived there, Motherwell lived there. Wow. So we had a very famous summer crowd. But basically, you had two jobs. You were either an artist or a fisherman. Right. And my family didn't really fit into either of those, because we came from Connecticut, but that's where I grew up. And then thankfully, my summers were spent with my grandparents. And so they would take me to the Metropolitan all the time. And my mother knew I loved art, and I was a very good young artist. And so she would take me to the museums all the time. And when I was about 10 years old, we were moving from Provincetown to Florida. Now, that's a huge leap in culture and life in every possible way. And on the trip down, we stopped at the National Gallery of Art, and I thought I was in heaven. This was the most exciting period. I had been to the museums before with my grandparents in New York, but I had never been to the National Gallery. And it was something about the light and the openness. And then they had in every gallery, they had a guide. And I don't know whether you ever saw, you're probably too young, but it told you about every single painting in the room. You saw the paintings on the wall, they had very minimal labels, but this gave you more descriptive labels. Sure. And I thought, this is just heaven. It's absolutely heaven. So I have a very visual memory. And so at the end of, my mother took me there for 2 days in a row. My brothers went to the Smithsonian, other museums, the History Museum, the Natural History Museum. I didn't care about any of that. I just wanted to go back to the National Gallery. And I bought dozens of postcards. Yeah. And then I recreated the galleries in a notebook and had that for years and years and years. And so I relived that experience over and over again, even though I was in hot Florida. Yeah. And so it was just an awakening. And there were two paintings. One was the Tondo by Raphael of the Madonna and Child. And I just thought, this just has to be the most beautiful painting I've ever seen. And then later I saw the Renoir little girl holding a water can, which reminded me, I'm embarrassed to say, a lot of myself. She was just in the blue dress with that sparkling blondish hair and holding this little watering can in the garden. And that was something that I did with my parents for years. And Renoir has a wonderful way of painting flesh in children. And it was, you know, they were very different paintings, but they both have stayed in my soul forever. And so that was when I knew I was going to go work in an art museum for the rest of my life, which I've been able to pretty much do. A long career in museums, and I'd worked at the Winnipeg Art Gallery, at the New Orleans Museum of Art, at the Smithsonian's, at the Seattle Art Museum. I've been consultants to over almost 250 museums around the country, art museums in particular, but also natural history and zoos and botanic gardens. Botanic gardens are very similar. It's like the living version of an art museum. Everything has to be no touch and quiet. However, through that saga, I was in San Francisco, and I was working first at the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive, where I was the deputy director. And then from there, I left to come here to Dallas. And I had been in Berkeley for 10 years and loved it. I didn't like the earthquakes, but I loved my work there. And Jack Lane, and I also worked at a... After 5 or 6 years, I left the Berkeley Art Museum and went to work for the National Golden Gate Parks there and ran a museum called the Bay Area Discovery Museum, which is an indoor-outdoor facility on a historic site. Our buildings were 150 years old, built before the Civil War, and they were intended to guard the fort, the gate, Golden Gate, as we know it today. And so it was a huge living artists program. We brought in all kinds of artists to draw from the environment and to teach children and adults about the importance of caring for the ecology and the creative spirit of people in the Bay Area. And so I did that for 5 years. People, my art museum friends would come and they'd say, why are you in this museum that's, you know, not a serious art museum? And I would look at them and say, when have you ever had anybody hold on to your front door and scream, don't take me home? And that happened to me dozens of times every day, where the children, who really are the future of life, as we all know, the children would not want to leave. And that's because the quality of the experience with artists and scientists was so high and meaningful to them that they literally would hold onto the front gate screaming, no, take me home. So Jack Elaine was the director here, and Jack said, invited me to come. And it took 18 months and a lot of persuasion by the leadership trustees here in Dallas, Dee Dee Rose and Margaret McDermott, the Rachofskis, to get me to leave a very happy place in the San Francisco Bay Area and come to Dallas.
So how did they convince you?
Well, it was very funny. Two people made a huge difference. The first one was Margaret McDermott. And Margaret, I had many lunches with her, and she'd say, when are you going to make up your mind? Because, as I said, it took 18 months. And she finally said to me, you need to come to Dallas because one person can make a difference. And I thought, oh, wow, that's a really interesting idea. And then and she was right. I mean, I came in with a big portfolio to transform the museum from a sleeping place to a place where the community engaged actively, and to build the collections, which I love doing. I love working with the curators and building, buying new works of art. And the other person who was so important to me was my son. And he came down, he kept saying, Mom, why is it taking you so long to leave San Francisco to come to Dallas? And I said, well, you know, I have the best of both worlds, and why do I want to do this? And he said, you want to do this because the people here are so fantastic. And he was just visiting. He was, you know, he was going through that struggle. He had just graduated from Boston University in philosophy. Now he writes for the New York Times. Right. And so David has always been like, even though he's my son, he's like so perceptive. And he saw the wavering was not so much about the opportunity, but about giving up an experience in a place that I loved, where I had a lot of friends, and taking the risk to come and build a whole new life when you're older. And what David said to me, you know, come here because the people are extraordinary and the art is extraordinary, was just sort of like this clarion bell that, as Margaret said, one person can make a difference. I didn't make a difference on my own. I did it with a great staff and because I love the collections and because people were so kind to me. But it was an extraordinary opportunity. In the 12 years I was at the museum, were the happiest years of my career. Except for now, of course, being at UT Dallas.
Yeah. Amazing.
Well, let me just tell you. So then the question is, how did I come to UT Dallas?
Right.
So here I am, happy as can be at the DMA, and unfortunately then I got this terrible virus. And my wonderful friend, Hobson Wildenthal, Hobson and I, who was the provost at the time, knew each other for a very long time and knew each other, of course, through Margaret. So we were at lots of events together. Hobson said, well, what about if you came out after you retire and I was getting my health back? He said, why don't you come and join us out at the university? And with the great support of Rick Battelle, who made a huge difference, Dean Kratz, they were the ones who encouraged me to really not sort of stay home, but to come back. And Rick was the best. He said, the thing you love to do the most is teach. Come and be a part of the teaching environment and teaching faculty and research out here. And it has been an extraordinary period in my career, and I've done things that I never would have done before without their support. And so I'm very, very grateful to be here.
And UT Dallas, likewise, very fortunate. Well, finally, I mean, speaking of the present, I also wanted to ask you about Do Something New. Mm-hmm. Now, anyone who's listening to this should look at Bonnie's Instagram, and you'll see this. Do Something New practice. I think I saw that you said something like 46,000 photos have been taken.
Right.
And it's remarkable. I mean, it's possibly the most original thing that I've seen anyone do on Instagram. Can you just tell us kind of how you got started doing this and what it's all about?
Well, this goes back to that challenge in 2000. In 2008, I got sick when I was negotiating the King Tut show in Vienna. And when I came back, I had this terrible lung infection that is still with me and grows. And so I worked for 3 more years under very difficult circumstances and then retired from the museum for health reasons. And that summer, I was desperately sad because I had left the job that I loved the most in my life. And they did a biopsy on me, and the biopsy was not good news. And so on July the 8th, 2011, I took a nap that afternoon after I finished hearing all the results and woke up, and I literally, you know how we all have a little pad of paper and a pencil by our bed? And I wrote down, I'm going to do something new. I'm going to do something new every day. I'm going to take an ordinary day and make it extraordinary by intention. And so I'm going to meet new people. I'm going to go to new places. I'm going to have experience with the old friends, the doing new things. So everybody around me is always like, okay, I have a new idea. And it can be big or little, because there are a lot of days that I can't do very much.
Right.
And it can be new flavors of ice cream, thank heavens. And I don't know why I wrote that down, but I'm so grateful I did. And then it can not be work or health, and I cannot carry forward. So in a day that I've done maybe 5 or 6 things, I only put 1 or 2 on Instagram, but I write them all down. I can't take one of those and roll it over. It ends at midnight every night. So there are nights when I'm scrambling around trying to do something new, because I go, oh my God, it's 11:45. So that's how it started. I thought I'd do it for, 20 or 30 days. And here I am. I think it's now 2075 is today. And so some of them are serendipity. Yesterday, I was in my doctor's office and in a new doctor's office. And she had the most amazing array of encouraging signs, around her office, like, eat chocolate. And, the only thing I can do is when times are tough is spin around in my chair. But they were just funny things that you could think about doing she's the head of medical services over at UT Southwestern. And it was just sort of fun to see the inside of somebody's life. And then others for me are like, I went over to the Monet show with a group of friends, and we managed to arrive at the wrong time. And one of my friends, who doesn't like hot air, insisted that I called the director of the museum, and we got him out of his chair, and he came over and gave us this amazing tour of the Monet show. So here you are, you plan an event, and then lots of things happen that are wrong, and it just keeps me alive to do this, and to find, I think a lot of it has come out of my practice of the power of observation, which we should cover another time, but It is this ability, cultivated ability that I have now of living life with joy, of being compassionate and aware of the needs of others, to meditate and be mindful and to look intensely, to, I think, some of the most powerful discoveries have been the importance of play, doing things that you just never would have done, but I have an excuse to do them because I have to do something new. And so each day I post on Instagram. I also post on Facebook, but I post on Instagram because it keeps me alive and keeps me real. Some days when my friends know that if I don't post for a couple of days, it's because I'm not feeling good.
Yeah.
And I just, even the simple act of posting is too much for me. And so then the phone calls and the texts start coming in and I go, oh yeah, no, I'll post. So it's been very wonderful to realize that there is a whole host of people that actually follow me. And you're one of them, and I'm very grateful. I also love your posts.
Well, thank you. This is, as I said, truly, truly inspiring, a real inspiration.
Yeah, it's about, people ask me, why do you do it? And I think the answer is very simple. It's about resilience. It's about, we all suffer. Everybody suffers. My body is not a very happy body. And so this notion of how do you bounce back, when you wake up in the morning and you're in horrific pain every single day and you can't breathe. And, so you can sit there and be sad, or you can decide, I'm going to refocus my energies and find things today to see an experience that I've never done before. And I've met amazing people through this, because one of the activities is meeting new people. So it's a huge gift in my life, and I can't stop it now.
you're committed.
It's a life commitment. It's a life commitment. But you're kind to ask. And now I teach it. I mean, this is important to know. I'm over at the Center for Brain Health, which is another UT center, UT Dallas Center. I teach a whole program on doing something new, and there's a series of 4 days of workshops that you go through, so you can learn how to experience this, and they're very interactive, and it helps you to develop your own practice by the time you're done.
Our guest today is Bonnie Pittman, and this is the Athenaeum Review podcast. Mm-hmm. Find out more at Athenaeum Review.